Good morning and welcome to the Property and Local Tax Division. We'll call the meeting to order. And we have a busy and important day at the Capitol today, and I think you'll notice the pace is going to pick up dramatically here in the next week or so. So we'll kind of pull out of our backgrounding mode and start to actually process bills and so on. We will take up the minutes. Do I have a motion? Representative Barrett.
Madam Chair, I've looked over the minutes and they look really good. I'd like to make a motion to approve.
All right. Thank you. Representative Barrett approves the adoption of the minutes. Any discussion? Okay. If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. The minutes of February 2nd are approved. All right, and we do have one bill to process this morning, so we'll want to go ahead with that, and following that, we've got some presentations again, and we're still cranking up the equipment here. Okay. What should I mean? All right, and I'll just make note of the list of bills in your packet that have been referred to our committee. So these are some of the things we're getting prepared to hear. But we will move ahead. Representative Depke is bringing House File 88, and if you'd like to come to the table, Representative Depke, and tell us about your bill. And I'd like to move passage of House File 88 and we refer it to the Tax Committee.
So,
good morning, Representative, and yes. please state your name and for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Property Tax Committee. My name is Representative Connie Depke, and I'm going to be presenting to you this morning House File 88. And the description of this bill is removing the maintenance of effort and set aside for school personnel, returning financial decision making to school districts. This involves a $30 per pupil levy that the school districts are able to do for the Safe Schools levy that was passed in 2006. My bill removes the last paragraph in the bill, which is very prescriptive as to how, specifically how that the schools are to use that money. The fiscal note that I believe you have in front of you indicates that there is no fiscal impact. I have Mr. Crow with me today if you have any questions about the financial impact or the levy itself.
Representative Depke, if I understand right, this bill has already been passed through the Policy Committee. And our job here today is really just to understand the impact at the property tax level.
That's correct.
Okay. Mr. Crow, did you have comments? Okay. All right. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and whole Representative Depke. Representative Depke and I and a number of others worked on a whole series of mandate reductions for the public schools. Mm-hmm. We didn't meet with as much success as we had hoped. Mm-hmm. This particular issue, since I'm interested in many of the same objectives as Representative Depke has, is a little problematic for me, only in the sense that the Safe Schools levy, which really didn't work very well, did at least recognize a severe problem that the state of Minnesota is experiencing, and that is that the state of Minnesota is 49th in the nation in the number of school counselors in relationship to children. We know that upwards of one-third of all the school districts in the state or the school buildings in the state have no counseling services whatever. So my concern with this bill, although I agree that we need to return a lot of these decisions to local schools, we'd like it on the record at least that when we pass this legislation, we can assume that the number of students being served in our public schools, having counseling services, they will increase, and a number of counseling services will continue to decline. And when we read reports from school districts of suicides and other kinds of problems having to do with family problems or abuse on the part of other children in the schools, I just want the committee to understand that this decision does have significant consequences. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Depke, yes. Do you have a comment?
Yes. No, I want to thank Representative Benson for, I'm well aware of his issues, and I've done some more research for you. And since this is dealing with the impact on the property taxes, I would be very welcome to share some of the information with you that we have gleaned. Consequence to the hearing that I had with the school finance division. This particular levy, unfortunately, the maintenance of effort is proving to be a disincentive for some of the schools to hire additional counselors because of the maintenance of effort piece. So I will be happy to share that with my colleague, Representative Benson.
And are there folks in the audience that wish to testify either for or against the bill? Okay, are there other questions of the committee? Okay. I renew my motion that House File 88 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Tax Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right, thank you very much. The bill passes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Depke. Okay. All right, we'll move on to the next matter of business. We have Eric Ouellette. We've not heard from the Department of Revenue yet this session, so I think we can look forward to a presentation from them and sort of their interaction with the property tax system.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Ouellette. I am the Property Tax Research Director at the Department of Revenue. Joel is... I need to be able to see it too. Okay, thank you. All right, I think we're ready
there
to go now.
Mr. Ouellette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been asked to talk to you a little bit about the revenue estimates that we produce at the Department of Revenue. For each of your bills, the bills that you hear, you will see a sheet of paper from the Department of Revenue that attempts to estimate the impacts of the bill. And there have been some changes to those revenue estimates in recent years, so I've been asked to explain a little bit about what you see on those revenue estimates. And I was also asked to make some general comments about the property tax system as it relates to our scoring on the revenue estimates.
And I see you're starting at the very, very beginning.
Yes, Madam Chair, it's always good to start at the beginning. As you know, I should say that this some of this presentation came from an introduction presentation I did earlier. I tried to strip out everything that has already been covered by your able research staff, but if there's a little bit that's redundant, I apologize. In real broad terms, a property tax system, property is taxed according to its value, but with Minnesota system, what value is not uniform from one property to another, and there's a lot of features of our property tax system, many of which were discussed by the House Research Department in the overview, that affect different properties differently. So because of that, we have quite varying levels of taxation from one type of property to another. One of the purported virtues of the property tax system is that it's a very stable source of revenue compared to other taxes, and it is stable for the governments that raise the revenue the way it's structured in Minnesota, although it's not always so stable for taxpayers, partly because of all the complicated features of our system. And one of the most important things that you all hear about regarding our property tax system is that the property tax does not necessarily reflect the ability to pay of the property owner. It's a tax on the current estimated value of the property, not on the income of the property or the income of the owners. And that disconnect sometimes leads to a lot of the concerns that lead to legislation that, you all consider. So there's a mismatch between taxes owed and the income or the ability to pay of those who own the property, especially compared to our sales and income taxes, which generally track better what people's current ability to pay is. A brief history of our property tax. The property tax is our oldest major tax. The first territorial legislature formalized and established a property tax. One of their first acts of the first territorial legislature was to enact a school levy, a territorial levy, and county authority for county governments to use the property tax. And at that time, most personal property was included in the tax base, so the base of the property tax was much broader 150 years ago. Livestock, watches, pianos, just about everything was, even money, even cash in the drawer was subject to the property tax if the assessor knew about it. As you can imagine, there were some compliance issues with the personal property in those days. And there, the assessors can tell stories of herds of livestock being shifted from one farm to another, depending on whether the assessor was due to come visiting. Those may just be apocryphal stories, but nonetheless, they're part of the how we understand the property tax and explain part of why we no longer tax most personal property. Since 1913, Minnesota's had a classified property tax system, and I'll talk about the classification system very briefly in a little bit, but that basically means that depending on the use of the tax, the rate of the property tax is higher or lower for different types of property. In more recent times, our property tax system and our tax system in general had a very significant reshuffling in the years about 1968 to 1972, commonly referred to as the Minnesota Miracle, which in broad terms reduced property taxes by increasing income and sales taxes, eliminating a lot of school levies and replacing those with state shared revenues, eliminating a lot of miscellaneous local government taxes and instituting local government aids for cities, and imposing levy limits on local governments. So the change from before and after the Minnesota Miracle was really one of the state taking over the lion's share of raising revenue for funding government, reducing property taxes, but also putting a lot of restrictions on the financing of local governments. So it was sort of a trade-off, state money for state control through levy limits and a forbidding of using most local taxes besides the property tax. And then finally, in 2001, the most recent major reform of our property tax system was commonly known as the Big Plan, Governor Ventura's effort to reduce property taxes statewide, again, by eliminating a lot of school district levies, by redoing aids to local governments, imposing levy limits again that, on local governments, and changing our classification system. It also imposed a state tax on business and cabin property. The state had been out of the property tax business since the Minnesota Miracle, but as of the time of the Big Plan, the state got directly back into collecting property taxes. Okay, so when at the Department of Revenue, when we think about the property tax system, we think about who's responsible for what. And most of the administration of the property tax system is done at the county level. There are 3,300 individual taxing jurisdictions, 2.5 million parcels. A total market value of taxable property is almost $600 billion, and the property tax system raises over $8 billion of revenue a year. Our role at Department of Revenue is mostly to do oversight of the county administration of the system. We do studies and force equalization of assessments from one jurisdiction to another to make sure that assessment levels are relatively uniform across the state. We monitor compliance with the tax laws. We do licensing, education, and training of local property tax officials. And then we also do research on property taxes, and that's where my role is really centered.
Mr. Ouellette, if I could just ask, when you say equalization of local assessments, then what is your actual role? What are you looking at, or
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we conduct what's called a sales ratio study annually, where we look at the sales data for every property real estate transaction in the state. We determine whether it's we do this in cooperation with the local assessors. We determine whether those sales reflect arm's length transactions, open market transactions, and if they do, then we compare the sale price to the assessment and see how close the assessment was to the actual sales price. Now, for any individual sale, there's a number of reasons why those numbers may not be exactly the same. But when you get a large number of sales together, you can collectively see how well an assessor's judgment on the assessed value of a property matches what the market transaction of those are. And so by comparing the assessed value to the sale price with a large number of sales, we can measure whether an assessor is generally way under what they're selling for, over what they're selling for. And the local assessors use those studies to determine their next year assessments. If they're way off, or if there's a significant difference, and they're not making what we determine to be enough corrective action, the Commission of Revenue has the authority to step in and force a reassessment of a property type in a jurisdiction up or down to make sure that those assessment levels are relatively matching what's going on in the market.
I think we have a question. Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ouellette, one of the complaints we get from taxpayers from time to time, I think, is on this equalization. I'm just wondering, when they find out about their market value and the assessor tells them what's from information and a market study that was done a couple years ago, 2 years ago, could you explain that and why that's necessary, and if there is a way to make that a little bit more efficient as far as the timeline on that? Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Crawford, we do use historical sales data. The transactions that have already taken place are really the only information we have, and the studies do take a little bit of time, so there's a bit of a lag between the period of time that we use the sales and when those sales are applied to an assessment. So there is some lag built into the system. We are looking at our methodology for how we measure that and seeing whether or not we can get those assessment levels to better match the current market. And that's getting into a pretty technical level. I'd be happy to talk about it. I don't know if now is the right time, but we are aware of that tension, and it really showed itself recently when we had property values going down in the market, but the assessment levels in some jurisdictions were still going up because of the historical sales data. So we're looking to do some corrective measures on that. The next time the market takes a downturn, the assessors would have the flexibility to turn those assessments around a little bit more quickly.
Representative Dietrich?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ouellette, when we start talking about, you know, assessing properties and all that type of stuff, you know, to me at least, it just seems like such an archaic process and a very expensive process. You know, it almost seems like, you know, if 15, 20 years ago, if you would say, still delivering the mail just by a man going to your mailbox, this seems really old-fashioned and archaic. And now we have the internet, and we have email. When we were in our One Minnesota conference for the day, the speaker at the end of the day, Larry Kegel, I think his name is, or something like that, Kilo, he had talked about a state actually looking into the algorithm for Zillow.com, and I'm wondering if you're familiar with Zillow.com or if you think that there is ever any potential for a state to electronically, more efficiently, more effectively figure out property values and do all that type of stuff.
Mr. Ouellette?
Madam Chair and Representative Dietrich, at the risk of not seeming as young as I might look, I'm not familiar with Zillow.com, so I might be a little behind the times. But I will tell you that the Department of Revenue has been working very hard with counties to implement a real-time electronic certificate of real estate value, which is the document for the real estate transaction. So we would get sales data at the time the transactions take place. We still would be limited in our sales study to the sales that have already taken place, but at least we would have them coming in real time, mm-hmm. and that will be a great assistance in terms of modernizing. It was not that long ago when we were still getting the little pieces of paper and doing the data entry at the department. So we've come quite a ways. We've got some ways to go yet, but I think we're on the right track for modernizing this process.
Thank you.
Representative Dietrich, any follow-up?
No, thank you.
All right. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Willett, do you have any idea what the assessments cost the state of Minnesota? In aggregate.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, that's an excellent question, and I don't know. I do know that a number of years ago, the department, as part of the preparation for the big plan, attempted to quantify all the administrative costs of the property tax system. Because they are diffused through 87 counties and several hundred cities and townships that have their own local assessors, and because the accounting is different for different local governments, it proved very hard to collect that information. It is a pretty labor-intensive process to do assessment, and unlike the income tax, most of the cost of compliance is borne by the government. It's not an individual's responsibility to submit forms about the value of their property. So it is, in terms of administrative overhead, an expensive tax, but I can't quantify it for you.
Peterson?
Well, and I may be ignorant on this subject matter area, but to Representative Dietrich's point, my father, for example, works in the real estate business, and the notion that a market value assessment would take a year that doesn't happen on the private side. What is the difference maybe between that I'm maybe not taking into account between the private market, where you can get what they call a CMA on the residential side in a matter of a couple of days versus a year when it comes to property tax assessment?
Mr. Ouellette?
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, I apologize if I misspoke. It's not that it takes the assessors a year to conduct the judgment. It's that they do it once a year, and they do it so that all the properties measured at the same date, so that for tax purposes you're comparing apples to apples. If they did it on a rotating basis throughout the year, then depending on whether the market was inflating or deflating, those that were assessed earlier in the year might be paying more or less tax than those that were assessed later in the year. So the trick for assessors is to once a year draw up a tax list or a assessment roll, I'm sorry, of all the property, and try to measure at that one point in time how all the properties within their jurisdiction were valued. When they need to do reassessment or reappraisal for a tax court challenge or something like that, it doesn't take them any longer than it takes the private market to measure or judge one any particular property. So the annual cycle is that they only are doing an official assessment once a year for the purpose of taxation. Does that help?
Yeah. That's good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ouellette. Oh, Representative Lomcheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that point, Mr. Ouellette, can you remind me, I'm just trying to remember, the year I came to the legislature was the year Governor Ventura came to the place, and what did he do? Was it that he said you didn't have to let the government in your house, and he changed how often the years were that folks had to get on the property from like every five? Or can you recall that,
Mr. Ouellette?
Madam Chair and Representative Lomcheski, I cannot. I do know that we went from a quartile to a quintile reassessment,
okay,
every 4 years to every 5 years for reassessment, but I don't know the exact timing of that. Maybe the House staff does.
Mr. Hines?
Madam Chair, I know that there was some adjustment in the rules governing when what you had to do when an assessor came to the property, and I think we might have backed off some of that, but I can't remember exactly what that change was. I don't know if anyone else in the department or anyone else in the audience might know that, but there was some adjustment made, and I think we may have even backed off a little of that since that time.
Have we found a resource in the audience? Some of these arcane details we can forget, obviously.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Would you state your name for the record?
My name's Tom May. I'm a retired assessor from Hennepin County. I worked there for 34 years. The change that was made, actually prior to this change, there was a statute that required that taxpayers allow the assessor access to the property. The change that was made is it gave the taxpayer the ability to refuse entry, but the outcome of that would be then they could not appeal their value to the board. So it was kind of a trade-off. You can not let them in, or the assessor in, but then you can't appeal your value. If you do, you'd have to let them in.
Representative Chesky?
Just trying to remember.
All right, great. Thank you very much. Mr. Ouellette, please proceed.
Okay. This chart is our attempt to sort of map out all the various features of the property tax system that allow different types of property to be taxed differently. It's a bit complicated, and I think that's sort of reflective of the how complicated our system is. But in the interest of time, I won't go into all the details here, but I'll just say that there are a lot of different features of the tax system that can change burden. You can have some of the base, some of your value, excluded from or exempted from the tax. You can have a special valuation feature. We can have different tax bases where we use classification or don't use classification. We also have features where different rates, tax rates, are applied to the properties. And then once the tax bill is calculated, there are credits and refunds that can change, that can give some money back or reduce the tax burden after all the calculations. I think a lot of these were covered in your overview section, so in the interest of time, I'm not going to go over them again, but I'm happy to field questions as they relate to what I cover later on. The next two pages show our classification system. I think Mr. Hines spoke about it in your overview. I just wanted to add a little bit about how Minnesota compares. We do have a very highly classified system compared to most states. And while it's really hard to compare the tax laws from one state to another, as best as we can tell, our 55 class rates put us quite far and away beyond every other state in the country. In fact, we think number two is South Dakota with 14 classes. Most states, 30 states, have five or fewer classes. Many states have a single class system where it doesn't matter what the use of the property is. It's only the value that matters for tax purposes. But we do have 55 discrete classifications. There are only 8 different class rates, we do have 55 different definitions for different types of property for property tax purposes. So this is one area where we are a bit of an outlier nationally. Those different features of the tax system that change the burden, I wanted to try and visualize what that means in terms of how the burden is shared. The left-hand bar on this chart shows the distribution of estimated market value by type of property. Farm at the bottom, cabins are the gold, small gold bar. Residential property is the big chunk in the middle. And this is the percent of the total estimated market value. This is the assessor's assigned value. Business property. And then at the top, the orange is property that's exempt from taxation by statute or by the Constitution. As you move to the second bar, once you eliminate the exempt and excluded value, that gives you your taxable market value by those same categories. So the orange category goes away. All the other categories get a little bit bigger share of the pie because the pie is smaller. Once you apply our classification system where you have a different class rate depending on use, the business share gets a whole lot bigger because their class rates are higher. The residential and agricultural shares get smaller because their class rates are relatively smaller. So most of our property taxes are spread on what's called net tax capacity, and this would be the rough distribution of taxes using the net tax capacity chart. So the change from bar 2 to bar 3 is the impact of our classification system on the distribution of taxes among tax types. So because of classification, business pays more per dollar of value. Homes and agricultural property pay less per dollar of value. But there's a final step, which is this is just the tax base. The final step is the actual final incidence of our property tax once you take into account not just classification, but also the credits that are and refunds that are paid to some owners, as well as the state property tax, which only increases taxes on the business and the cabin share of the pie. So once you go from step 3 to step 4, you see that for every dollar of value, businesses are paying a much higher share of taxes than other types of property. the big reduction in residential property, the market value credits, and the property tax refund program. Okay. So in our system, as well as with most other states, our preferred classes are residential and agricultural at the expense of other types of property. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about tax principles, and I want to give you a little bit of background here, and Representative Dietrich knows a lot of this intimately. She was very involved in this last year. There's been some growing concern about the complexity of our property tax system and how many different features we have that can shift burden from one type of property to another, and the fact that there are so many, and there have been so many added over the years, that it's very difficult for the taxpayer or even for local officials or for you as legislators to really be able to understand and explain to a taxpayer why their tax is what it is. So there's what we call a transparency problem with the property tax system. Those concerns and conversations about those concerns led to some legislation that passed last year that did a number of things. It established a property tax working group that is looking at the property tax system opportunities for potential simplification. That group has been meeting since the summer. It's meeting about once or twice a month now, I think. Maybe every once a month right now. The legislation also identified the principles that should guide sound tax policy. And these come out of economic literature. This is sort of standard what sorts of things you want in a tax system, what you want to look for. Those principles are generally speaking, simplicity, efficiency, equity, stability, competitiveness, and responsiveness. And I'll talk a little bit more about each one individually. But the legislation didn't just identify them. It said, we would like the legislature to get information about how new proposals coming in affect the property tax system in relation to these principles. And that is what has led to this new box that's on the back of every revenue estimate that we do starting this year for property tax bills only. So the idea was that we would provide some additional, the main purpose of the revenue estimates is to give you the fiscal impact of a bill. Does it raise or lower state revenues? And does it what impact does it have on taxpayers at the local level, which is what we traditionally have done in the revenue estimates. This requirement takes a step further and says, what else can you tell us about the proposal in terms of its effect on the property tax system as a whole? And that's what we're trying to do. So the goal is to give you information about the impact of the bill beyond the fiscal impact. So how do we do that? And in your packet, there's a two-page handout that says Property Tax Principles Rating Summary for Revenue Analysis. And this is sort of our attempt at a cheat sheet for understanding why we're doing what we're doing with these revenue estimates. So what we do, just like with the fiscal part of the revenue estimate, we compare the impact of a bill to current law. So under current law, what is the system like? If this bill were to become law, how would that change the system? So we're comparing current law to the alternative if this bill were to become law.
Is that in our packets?
We don't have it.
Is it not in the packets?
Apparently not.
Yeah, I luckily brought a bunch of extra copies.
Oh, okay.
And much of this information will be on the slides as well. So it's mostly in the slides as well. So I'll keep going, even though you don't yet have this in front of you. We don't attempt to measure the relative magnitude of the change. We just try to say whether it's an increase or a decrease or there's no change. I should say we met with legislative staff over the summer several times to sort of work out how we were going to do this. And we did a lot of test runs with various bills from previous sessions, and one of the things that we learned was that it's really hard to draw a line between what's a moderate change and what's a significant change when you're talking about does it make the system more complex. So rather than trying to split hairs like that, we just decided that to start out with, we'll just tell you whether it's an increase, a decrease, or no change. So, and we also try to identify what perspective we're looking from. When it comes to property taxes, There's really several valid perspectives. Is the change good for taxpayers, for the state, for the administrators of the system? So we try to identify who we're referencing when we identify an impact. And finally, we're primarily interested in measuring the long-term impact on the system. A bill may have a short-term disruption to the property tax system by making a change, but in the long run, it may increase stability in the system. In that case, we would focus on the fact that the main impact, the long-term impact, is an increase in stability, but we would note maybe that there would be a short-term different impact in it. So with those prefatory comments, let me talk a little bit about each of the principles and how we think about them when we're doing one of these revenue estimates. The first one is transparency, understandability, simplicity, and accountability. And really what we're trying to get at here is that taxpayers should understand how their tax is determined, which governmental unit is responsible for the tax, and what services are funded by the tax. So again, we're not measuring how good is the system right now. It's the bill that's in front of you. Does it make the system we have better or worse in this regard? So even though we may have a very untransparent system, if a bill that's before you would make it slightly less transparent, we would score it as an improvement in transparency. Even though the system might still be horribly non-transparent, it's a step in the right direction. And that's really what information we're giving you. So we're not measuring the system as it is. We're measuring the changes to the system under the bill. So really the questions we ask ourselves when we look at a bill, does the bill make the system clearer for the taxpayer, for public officials, for the administrators of the system? Are decision makers identified clearly or more clearly under this proposal? So does the proposal make it easier to understand what's going on with property taxes? So an example of maybe a feature that if it were enacted that we would score as an improvement would be our truth in taxation notices. While they're not perfect and they can confuse people, they're certainly better than the alternative of giving no heads up to the taxpayer about what their tax bill might be next year. So we would consider that to be a feature that would improve the transparency of the property tax system if it were being enacted today. And there's plenty of examples I could pick that if they were enacted today, we'd probably score as reducing transparency, because a lot of what we do in the tax system is creating special carve-out benefits to a subset of property, and those generally, and especially in an additive fashion, reduce the transparency of the system because you can end up with a lot of different things impacting a tax. As a side note to this, one of the challenges with transparency, and I should say that a lot of these principles can sometimes come into conflict. You'll see proposals where the same proposal can increase the transparency of the system, but make that better, but increase the administrative cost as well. So there's a tension between the principles where it's very hard to sort of score well on all the features at the same time. And I should also note, since you'll be the main consumers of this information, these scores are not meant to judge the worthiness of the proposal, because generally every bill has a goal that is not to increase these principles. The goal is something else. So these are not meant to be a judgment on the bill. They're meant to be information that should be taken into consideration when you decide whether you want to enact it or not. Let me move on to efficiency and compliance. What this means is that the tax should maximize voluntary compliance. The system should be easy to follow, and the law should be easy to follow, and it should minimize economic distortions caused by tax-motivated behavior and minimize compliance and administrative costs. So basically this gets to the question Representative Peterson was asking. Does a bill make it much more expensive to run the system, either for the taxpayer to comply or for the administrator to run it? And secondarily, is it easy for the people who are administering the system to make the determinations necessary to fairly apply the system to all taxpayers? If we have a feature that where the language of the law is vague or hard to discern, we may have assessors that are not uniformly applying the law across the state. We have uniformity problems, and we also have that makes the system less efficient in terms of fairly treating all taxpayers. So in terms of efficiency and compliance, our market value homestead credit would probably score pretty highly on this because the taxpayer doesn't have to do anything to get the credit. It just shows up on the tax bill. It's easy to calculate because it's based on the market value of a property. So it's easy for the assessor to determine what that credit should be. One that might be harder in terms of efficiency is homestead determination. Our laws governing whether a property qualifies for homestead benefit, especially an agricultural property, is very complicated, and it's very hard across the state for all assessors to uniformly apply the law. I've been remiss in forwarding the slides. Equity. The tax should minimize regressivity. That's what we refer to as vertical equity, and it should treat similar properties similarly. That's what we call horizontal equity. As you probably know, the property tax is what we refer to as a regressive tax. That is, the tax burden generally is higher as a percent of income at low income levels than it is at higher income levels. And according to generally to good tax policy, you should try and minimize regressivity and at least aim for a proportional tax system. So one of the questions we ask under here is, do tax burdens increase or decrease as incomes rise under the proposal? How does the proposal change that? So if you were to beef up the property tax refund, which is income tested, that would probably decrease the regressivity of the system and make it a little bit less regressive. So that would score as an increase on this proposal. If you were to eliminate the property tax refund, that would make the system more regressive. Now there's two kinds of equity here. That's vertical equity. Horizontal equity is, are like properties treated alike? If you have two properties that look the same, have the same features, are they being taxed at the same rate? This one poses some challenge for us in terms of scoring the bills, because many of the bills that will come before you, what they're trying to do is to create a difference between how some properties are treated versus others. So, for example, if you were to create a new class and carve out a portion of the commercial industrial, say you think that a certain type of industry should be taxed at a lower rate than all other industries, so you want to create a new class for them.
Let's not give him any ideas. Okay?
But an example like that, technically you're kind of violating horizontal equity because you're creating a difference between two properties that currently are treated the same. However, that's kind of the main point of the bill, so it struck us in conversations with legislative staff for it to be kind of strange for us to say that you're violating horizontal equity, because by definition you're writing the law to say no, these are different properties. So we're really likely to not get into horizontal equity very much unless we think there's a horizontal equity problem that's being created by the bill that's an unintended consequence of the bill as opposed to being the point of the bill. If you're rewriting the law to say this property is different than this property, we're not going to step in and say you're violating horizontal equity. You're just redefining what horizontal equity means. Whereas if you're creating a change to the system and it's creating differences among properties that we don't think is purposeful but accidental, then we'll point that out on the revenue estimate as being a horizontal equity concern that you should probably think about. So that one's a little bit complicated, but again, we're just trying to offer information.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Willett, in regards to your slide and the last statement regarding the horizontal equity, I'll give you an example of how I think the formula sometimes doesn't work. In the case of Delano, we had two buildings that were commercial, industrial, side by side. One was vacant, one was a car lot. And as you're probably familiar with the last 4 or 5 years, cars haven't been selling like hotcakes. Well, unfortunately, in this scenario, the building that was empty sold for a pretty high value. And based on historical data, of course, the assessor would rate all commercial buildings in that quadrant similar to the building that sold. And therefore, the car dealership value went up significantly, and consequently, his property tax went up as well throughout the next couple of years. And, of course, on local businesses, it's very, very tough. for him, and I think that in there, their formula is broken. Something's not working. It's forcing businesses, of course, to raise their products in a competition world, and automobiles is very tough to do. So it's very tough to him for him to continue in business because of that formula. Can you address some of the inequities in regards to horizontal the equities, please? Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, I will try. I think this is more of an issue of a problem of one of the issues I raised earlier, which was the mismatch of the market value and the ability to pay. If there are two parcels next to each other and one sells for a decent amount of money in an open market, someone's willing to pay that much, the way the property tax system works is that like properties should be valued similarly because that is what the market value is. That does cause a hardship for, especially in a down market, for a business that's trying to keep in. And I'm not sure of the particular circumstances. There may have been other things going on in the example that you cited. One of the challenges is when there are a small number of sales but not a large number of sales, it's hard to determine how much you should read into any individual sale in terms of what that means about the local market and whether that other property really would sell for that same amount. And I'm not an assessor, so I'm kind of straying on the edge of my, or maybe I'm well beyond my expertise already. And maybe Tom Mays standing behind me wanting to correct me. But I do think that at least the way I heard your example, that is kind of how a property tax system is supposed to work. If a property of one type is selling for X and that is indicative of the market, then even though it would cause a hardship for the one who doesn't have an interest in selling, that is what the market value of the property is, and that's what we use for tax purposes. Whether there should be safeguards for any particular market or not, I suppose, for any particular property owner in terms of increasing taxes, that's a separate issue from what the value should be for tax purposes. That's my first
thing. Oh, just, you're right. I mean, it's a catch-22 because for the property owner whose value went up, it's great if he goes to sell, if he has a buyer. But for those who want to continue in business, it is it's a hardship. Very tough for them to continue to do business in that fashion. But that's the way the system is, and unfortunately, I think it's there's some inequities there. I don't know how to fix it myself, but that is the system, that's the formula, and it's undue hardship, unfortunately, for those who don't wish to sell and continue to do business.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, that's not dissimilar to the senior citizens who've been living in the same home for 50 years and they could easily afford the taxes when they first bought it, but the value has appreciated significantly in their time in the home, their income has gone down. That can provide a similar hardship where you've got a mismatch between current ability to pay and value of the property that they're living in. And there are no easy answers. There's a lot of possible answers, and if you look across the country at the different ways property tax systems have been adjusted, most of the solutions have consequences for the rest of the tax system that can really complicate things, like, you know, California Proposition 13 or Florida's Save Our Homes, where you use acquisition value or you cap taxes to increase only by a certain percent a year. These are policies that have been tried in states, and they have the virtue of shifting that stability to the taxpayer, but shifting the stability away from the local governments that rely on the revenues. So there's really a trade-off in creating a property tax system between, you know, how much stability you want individual taxpayers to have, how much protection you want to give them, whether you want to give them protection by capping their taxes or through an income-tested refund program, which is the route that Minnesota has taken for homesteads. There's a lot of different options. For businesses, we don't have a property tax refund for businesses. So that, in your example, there is no redress there.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to piggyback on what Representative McDonald was saying regarding the discrepancies in values. I guess the way I look at it, so I'd like to make a statement and get your comments on that. If you look at 10 homes in any section of town, they're all there for a particular purpose, to house a family. So you could look at the 10 and make a determination based on the value of one sale on the remaining 10, potentially. There are variables there as well, but I would argue that businesses are different. They're there for a particular purpose. They have a particular building or a particular acreage based on what that business does. I would argue you can't make a determination on the remaining nine. You potentially wouldn't be able to on the remaining nine properties because a business is unique, more unique than a residential property. Are you saying that nine properties could increase in value because of a sale of one business property? Is that what I heard currently happens?
Mr. Lett.
Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, no. One sale certainly is not enough evidence for an assessor to do anything. We do have parts of the state where sales are very few and far between, especially for commercial and industrial property. In parts of the state where there are more sales, assessors are able to split their market, look at office buildings of a certain size and only look at sales of similar properties, look at fast food restaurants because they're kind of the same, and that sort of thing. It does get very tricky in greater Minnesota, parts of greater Minnesota where there aren't very many commercial industrial sales. There's less evidence of the market, and it is harder for assessors to find comparable sales. We do try to supply statewide sales data as much as possible, but markets vary. So it's a system where there's imperfect information. But certainly in the metro area, at least in good times when there are transactions going on, the assessors certainly don't lump all commercial properties into one bucket and say, well, that's the market. They do careful study and they split the market into similar properties as much as they can. This might be a case where if you're interested in assessment issues, you should have a couple of assessors up here answering these questions rather than me.
Just a follow-up.
Yeah, I have Representative Barrett.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair. If sales are part of the process, which they are, we could question whether it's one sale or two. Do businesses that go out of business for any particular reason, would they impact another business's property tax in the next year? Rather than sales, if a sale happens and they sell for X amount more than what the property was valued at, would also, if a business goes out of business, would that negatively impact the property values around it?
Mr. Willett.
Madam Chair, vacancy rates and rents and that sort of data are also data points that assessors use when it's available. So, yes, that could affect how the assessor measures the market.
Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were, before you were discussing, Mr. Willett, the complexity of the Minnesota property tax system compared to other states. And, we think of the federal tax system with all its barnacles and its myriad exemptions and changes that have taken place. And many of us see that as successful workings of well-paid lobbyists over the last 50, 60, 70 years. None of us are very happy with that. And talk of tax reform always comes around and we don't hear anything actually ever happening. But I'm wondering, isn't it also true that complexity can improve fairness in tax receipts and the way it's collected? For example, if we were to do something to solve Representative McDonald's concern here, we would have to add more complexity, would we not, to the Minnesota tax system? And how do you explain the fact that Minnesota has all this? My take on it is that the legislatures, and past legislatures, have been attempting to a greater extent in this state to make the tax property tax code fairer for various groups of payers, since there is such a diversity between greater Minnesota and the metropolitan areas, for example, and businesses of various kinds. So just wondering, when you look at this tax code, and I think many people will say, well, we have to do something to simplify this system, would we not be taking a chance in making the tax system we have right now less fair and less equitable?
Mr. Willett.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, yes, that's an excellent point. As I said, these principles are trade-offs amongst each other, and I think it's fair to say that a lot of the features of the system, most if not all the features of the system at the time they were enacted to address a perceived unfairness in the outcome of the system. And so the fact that our complexity is what it is a sign that this body is very sensitive to the fairness of the property tax. I think one of the reasons that simplicity is such a challenge is that to achieve greater simplicity, you would have to make some difficult trade-offs about how the burdens of the system are spread. I do think that there's, or I would at least hypothesize or suggest that there is a tipping point beyond which, when you have so many fairness features, and they're all, in essence, shifting taxes onto other property, you've got shifting back and forth where the effectiveness of the individual features has lost some of its oomph. That's a technical term we use at the Department of Revenue. one of the things that we are trying to think about and explore with the working group is there so much conflicting attempts at fairness that the individuals sum up to less than, or the total is less than the sum of the individual pieces, and are there ways to achieve much of the goals but in a more simple manner, which seems to be maybe the only recipe for simplicity that would actually pass the other tests of fairness and the like.
Representative Benson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, tell us, have you succeeded?
Madam Chair and Representative Benson,
are you succeeding?
I'm relieved to say that the report of the working group is still several months away, so we've still got a lot of work to do. As you can imagine, there's been a lot of these sorts of presentations to sort of get the members familiar with the system and all of its features, and we're just starting to dig into particular pieces of it. So I can't predict the outcome, but they are working in earnest to bring you something that you can react to.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McDonald. Okay. All right. Mr. Ouellette.
Okay. The next principle that that will show up on the back of all of your revenue estimates is stability and predictability. A good tax provides stable source of revenues over the economic cycle. A significant and the tax laws are relatively stable. There aren't surprises to the taxpayer, and shocks to both governments and to the taxpayer should be minimized. This is one that is even internally in conflict, not just in conflict with the other principles. So this one is particularly difficult because, as I mentioned earlier, oftentimes what increases stability for the local governments decreases it for the taxpayers and vice versa. Not universally, but sometimes that is the case. So there are features that increase the stability for taxpayers or local governments, and there are others that reduce them. And certainly when laws are changed suddenly and dramatically, that would reduce the stability and predictability of the system. And we have had some of that recently. Okay. Competitiveness is the next one. Competitiveness for business is what we're specifically looking at. The system should minimize any competitive disadvantage of the state relative to other states and nations. When we look at competitiveness, we are specifically and narrowly looking at business competitiveness. And because of our, to keep this as simple and high level as possible, really with this one, what we're looking at is, does the proposal in total decrease or increase taxes on Minnesota businesses? The theory being, if business taxes go down, those businesses will be relatively more competitive with their competitors in other states. If they go up, they'll be less competitive. So this one is probably the easiest one to do and easiest one to score. It doesn't offer a whole lot of extra information, but it at least lets you know where enacting the bill would advantage Minnesota businesses compared to their rivals in other states and countries.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Watt, having been involved in working with Denise and others on developing these, you kind of look at them in another light when you see them again. And one of my questions about this one is it really is focused externally towards competing with other states and other nations, but I didn't see necessarily something in these categories that looks at competitive businesses within Minnesota, one type of business being advantaged versus another. Representative McDonald's idea of the car dealers are, compared to somebody else, or is someone who operates a retail business disadvantaged compared to someone who operates a timber cutting business, or those kinds of things. And do we have anything in these factors that looks at that, whether we incent the growth of a particular type of business versus another?
Mr. Ouellette?
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, we're not addressing that in this new scoring. I hope that our descriptions of the impact of the bill on the first page would make it evident who the benefiting properties are, and if it's and whether their savings are being shifted onto other properties which would disadvantage those other businesses and non-business property. So we're not including that in the competitiveness because, I guess to keep this feature doable in the time frame that we have to do to crank these out. But I do hope that information is available if you read the description of the bill, a bill that would exempt a particular industry or reduce its class rate or whatever. We would say in the description that these types of properties would have a reduction of estimated X dollars of tax. So it's sort of implicit in the description, but it's not in the ratings.
Thank you.
Representative Dietrich?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ouellette, also to that point, under equity, wouldn't that be included in horizontal equity then, if you are talking about businesses of certain types and exemptions or vertical equity? Because still the previous principles still apply to that. Classification.
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair and Representative Dietrich, in as much as it's an unintended consequence, we would point out the horizontal equity problems created by the bill.
Right. Mr. Ouellette.
Okay, the final one is responsiveness to economic conditions. A tax should change with changes in value. Lags in the system between a market change and a corresponding tax change should be minimized. This goes to Representative Crawford's issue that he brought up earlier. The ideal tax wouldn't have several years of lag between a change in the market and a change in the tax. So if a feature were, if a bill were before you that were to change one of those features that would increase or decrease a lag in the system, we would score that here. And this is one where so far I think everything we've done this year has been neutral on this one. So I'm not sure it's one you'll see a lot of scoring on. Okay, so those are the features that we look at when we add one of these boxes to a revenue estimate. I should point out that this is brand new. We spent a lot of time with staff this summer preparing, but we're just doing it in real time for the first time. So if there are suggestions for improvements or ways we could make it clearer or more useful, please let us know. It will be hard for us to make major restructuring to this in the midst of a session, but if there are tweaks that could improve it or major things you'd like us to think about over the summer about improving it for future years, that kind of feedback is really welcome. We want this to be as useful for you within the amount of time we can spend on it. And I should also say that this is new, and how much work this is going to be, we're still figuring out. There have been in the past times of the year where we're barely able to keep up getting you the numbers of the revenue estimates if you're hearing a lot of bills. So there may come a time where we temporarily drop these because we know you need the numbers primarily, and that's the most important part of what we do. If we do ever reach those circumstances, we would, as time allows, go back and fill these in and revise these to include these features. But unless you tell us differently, Our mode of operation will be to get you the revenue estimate numbers first and foremost in time for your hearings, and these as we're able to after that. Just sort of how we're going to process it. Just wanted you to be aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I just really want to commend Representative Dietrich, and I know Representative Loeffler worked on this, and all the staff that put this together, because it is really moving in the right direction, looking at the property tax system and the things we do and the consequences. I also want to thank the Department of Revenue, because you know, you can come up with all sorts of great ideas, but the ones who actually have to implement that and put this into effect, and I was very impressed on the first few bills that I forgot all about that till I saw those indicators on the back, but I really want to congratulate Mr. Ouellette and the Department of Revenue for your work on implementing this also. And I think with that property tax working group and some of the other things, I think we're starting to take a pretty good look at the property tax system and just some of these things and concerns we've heard around the table today and how we can, make it a better system and even trying to get some indicators on, what we're getting for all the dollars we spend out of property tax aids and credits, to cities and counties. And so commend everyone on all these efforts. So thank you.
All right, Mr. Ouellette, we're moving into a new section here.
Yes, report. Madam Chair, I was asked to also talk a little bit about some of the broader indicators of the property tax system, so I'll do that relatively quickly. There's going to be a lot of information in these next few slides that we could spend a lot of time on, but I know we don't have that time today. So I just want to make sure the committee members are familiar with these other resources they can use when they're thinking about property taxes. In that same piece of legislation that created these new revenue estimate requirements, a list of major indicators of the property tax system were identified, and I just want to go through those so that you're familiar with some of them. You've already heard about the price of government report is a part of what the MMB produces with every economic forecast, and this is a long-term look at state and local revenues and how they compare to personal income in Minnesota.
And members, some of these charts now that you're going to see are not in color, but we'll get you copies of in color later in the day.
Okay, I apologize for that. So looking at the screen might be a little bit more useful at this point. This first chart shows the mix of major tax revenues for state and local governments in Minnesota since 1962. And the dark blue is the property tax, and you can see how prior to what we refer to as the Minnesota miracle, the property tax was the primary source of revenue for government in Minnesota. With the Minnesota miracle, it was implemented the sales tax for the first time. That's that green bar that was at zero up until 1965 or 67, and then the sales tax was implemented, and income taxes were also increased at that same time. So the Minnesota miracle really, really shook up the basket, how we collect revenues in the state of Minnesota. Beginning in about 1980 through the mid-90s, the mix was very stable. And then with the volatility of income and sales taxes at the end of the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s, along with the big plan, we had another sort of a smaller shakeup where property taxes were temporarily reduced. Income taxes were reduced, keep in mind that this is a share of the total. This doesn't show absolute dollars. This is share of the total. So this is what percent each of these were of the total. In nominal terms, this shows property taxes, other taxes, and all other revenues since 1991. So this shows not just the mix, but also the growth in the total amount of own source revenues. And you can see the property tax has been growing relatively steadily other than the big plan reductions in the early 2000s. The third way to look at this is not just in nominal terms, but what is the take of government as a percent of personal income. So this chart shows own source revenue by the jurisdiction that's collecting it as a percent of Minnesota personal income. And as a percent of income, it's been relative.
Mr. Ouellette, sorry. Did you have a question, Representative Dietrich?
I did, and that is on the first price of government report. So this is, so is it safe to conclude that right now property taxes are the primary source of government spending? No.
Madam Chair and Representative Dietrich, property taxes and income taxes the last few years have been very close to each other in terms of the aggregate amount. I believe property taxes are now higher than income taxes for the first time since the late 90s.
So we are regressing back to the 60s and 70s.
Mr. Willett,
real property taxes.
Well, in this, Madam Chair, in the 60s, the property tax was three times the income tax. Now it's just a little bit more than. So we're going in that direction, sort of, but the order of magnitude was very different before the Minnesota miracle.
Cindy Jake?
So just out of curiosity.
Oh, can you please talk into the microphone, please?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Because you're a tax expert, they are close to being the same income and property tax, and property tax being the most regressive. So what has that done to our property tax system as far as regressivity, and how does that compare in the United States?
Mr. Willett.
Representative Dietrich, I have a chart that shows our... Actually, I'm going to get to our property tax rankings in a couple of minutes.
That would be fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
And in terms of the regressivity, that's more a better question for Paul Wilson, who does the tax incidence study, who looks at all the taxes. I really only look at one subset. So.
Okay. Thank you. We can
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that same line regarding property tax, as it relates to other forms of taxes, this shows that property tax is now number one. But the next slide, if you could go to the next slide, kind of hard to see, but the green area shows property tax. The orange shows all other taxes. It appears to me that the orange area is growing faster than the property tax area, which seems to contradict. I know the time frames are different. This is 91 to 13. The other one's 62 to 10. But it just seems like the all other tax area is growing if you look at the smaller orange compared to the larger orange on the right, and compare the small green to the larger green.
Mr. Willett?
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, I think that's because in this slide, the other includes several of the categories, whereas here we're comparing the other in three different lines. So in that first chart, you've got sales tax, income tax, and all other. If you were to put all three of those together, that's what would be shown up in the orange here. So you're kind of collapsing three different categories into one here. So that, but you're right. In this way, you're seeing a very big increase in the totality of other taxes, not just income taxes.
Right. Just wanted to make sure I was reading that correctly.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Willett.
So as a share of personal income, the total amount of own source revenues has been relatively stable since 2000 in the 15 to 16% of personal income. Looking specifically at property taxes now, this is property tax levies by the jurisdiction type that raises them since 1996. A couple of observations on this chart. You see in the middle of the chart the impact of the big plan, where school levies were significantly reduced and replaced with state aids. You see the imposition of the state property tax at the top starting in 2002, which partially filled in the difference for that reduction in school levies. So that impact is one of the main observations in this chart. The other one is that before the big plan, total property tax increases were about 4% a year but from 2002 to 2008, it was almost 7.5% a year. So the slope of increase sped up after 2001 for levy increases. A lot of that was because of school referenda levies, but also higher average levy increases by schools and counties or cities and counties. And that was the same era where local aids were being cut periodically. The last couple of years since the recession, increases in levies have been very, very low. In fact, this chart only shows the preliminary, but we do have the final 2011 increases, and the increase in property taxes statewide for 2011 was under 2%, which is the lowest in many, many, many years. So the recession has really had an impact on the increase in property taxes. Another sort of indicator that's important to keep track of with property taxes is market value trends. The market values, as we've discussed, is the first step in determining property taxes. The levies of local governments is the other main ingredient. And when property taxes values are, or when property values are changing at different rates among classes or among properties, you can have tax burdens shifting from one property type to another. All of the things being equal, if levies stay the same and one property's value goes up and another property's value doesn't, the property whose value is going up is going to pick up more of the share of that levy and relief will come to the other property. What you see here in the chart is that between from 99 to about 2007, significant continual increases in value across property type. Now, these increases include new construction. It's not just appreciation and value. But you really see the impact of both the housing bubble and increased value in ag land, especially since about 2004, where you had some really big increases. And then beginning in 2008, those increases moderated. These are the percent increases by year. And it's beginning in 2009, you had some classes of property in negative territory statewide in aggregate. And for a assessment year 2010, which is what we're using for taxes payable in 2011, the major classes all were negative other than agricultural land. So very different picture from 5 years previous.
Mr. Willett, just a question. In your one of your first slides, you said our total market value is $580 billion. Is that today, or what was it in 2005, for example?
Madam Chair, it would have been lower. No, that would have been for assessment 09, pay 010. It would have been lower in 2005, but higher in 2009. So we had a lot of increase from 05, 06, 07. Then the values started moderating, and now they're actually declining in aggregate statewide.
So our peak year was which was
2007 what? Assessment for 2008, I believe, was the peak year. Does that sound right, Steve?
But the total market value was still lower than today? Is that what you? I thought I heard you say that.
I'm sorry, you had said in 2005. In 2005, the value probably was lower because we were still having 10% increases from 05, 06, 07. Only small decreases since then. But our total value is lower today than it was in assessment year 2007, I believe.
Okay. I was
maybe
just looking for a number.
Yeah.
What was our peak market value?
And I don't have that off the top of my head, but I can I can look that up, or maybe Steve can have it in his
Representative mind. Leffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think this chart actually kind of puts in really nice context sort of the challenge before us, because we saw earlier that property taxes are now our largest share of income to support state and local government services at a time when all properties are underwater. They're declining in value except for ag. And so we're putting more expectations on the property tax base at a time when it's declining as in terms of its real value. And I think we need to really ponder what that means for us as policymakers going forward. And and just as politician, it means we're all going to have to get really good at explaining why your property tax bills are going up, even though your values are going down in all properties except ag. And so, I mean, I think this does kind of nicely frame sort of the circumstance that's really historically unusual. And I think it's a challenge to us to figure out, given that we're at a different place than we have been over the last 10 or 15 years, how do we react to that in establishing tax policy going forward? Because I think this is really, I've never seen this kind of a graphic demonstration of what's really been happening in the market.
Well, and you know, if in fact spending, you know, at the local level increased with the increasing valuations, you know, in the mid-decade, then I'm thinking we have to see the corresponding decrease in spending too to follow the value decrease. Was there another question? Okay, Mr. Willett.
Madam Chair, in the interest of time, I'm going to kind of gloss over the next slide, which is effective tax rates. This is the tax as a percent of the market value of the property. They were going up in the early 90s when values were increasing more slowly than levies. Then they were declining as values were increasing faster than levies. And now they're starting to go up again for the first time since the early 90s because of the phenomenon we just talked about. I want to talk a little bit about state tax rankings. This chart shows, based on Census Bureau data, how Minnesota's state and local tax collections as a percent of personal income compared to other states. And the blue is total state and local taxes, and the whatever color that is, orange, is the property tax in particular. And compared to other states, we rank better on the property tax than on taxes overall. Our income tax tends to raise our rankings when you look at total state and local taxes. But you also see on this chart the impact of the big plan where we reduced taxes significantly. And our rankings for property tax were, as a percent of personal income anyway, quite low. They've been creeping back up since the big plan, and we currently rank 31st in property tax revenues as a percent of personal income. Our rankings are a little bit higher in a per capita basis because we generally have higher personal income than the average state. This is the average for all property taxes, but it's important to note that our classification system means we rank better on residential tax across the country than we do on business taxes. And the Minnesota Taxpayers Association and the Lincoln Land Institute do an annual study of the 50, comparing the 50 states on their tax burdens by tax type. And what you'll see is, according to the most recent MTA, on a sample residential property in the largest city, we rank 22nd, but we rank 16th in industrial and 11th in commercial property. So we don't rank nearly as favorably on business property as we do on residential property. It's a different methodology, so they're not exactly comparable studies, but it's important to remember that because we classify as much as we do, looking at the aggregate general ranking can be misleading if you're a business owner, for example. I want to talk just a little bit about
Mr. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you know how does South Dakota and North Dakota rank in that same study?
Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, I do not remember off the top of my head how the Dakotas rank on. I know that Wisconsin does not classify the way we do, so their residential burdens are less favorable than ours, but their business burdens are more favorable than ours. But I forget about the Dakotas. We can get you a link to the report if that would be helpful.
Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on that question, there's discussion of lowering the corporate income taxes. My understanding that the effective rate is somewhere around 3.5%. How does our corporate income taxes, if you happen to know, rank with the rest of the states? We're sitting at 31st, which is fairly quite favorable, I would think, as far as corporate or property taxes, at least. And by the way, is that property tax 31st among the states include corporate property tax? Or do you know what the corporate property tax relationship is with the rest of the states?
Mr. Willett.
Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, in terms of the corporate income tax, I don't know anything about the corporate income tax, but I think Paul Wilson from our department could provide you some information on that. In terms of business taxes, this ranking 31st is the aggregate of all tax types. Okay. The Taxpayers Association says that for industry, we rank about, 16th, I think, or and then 11th for commercial. We generally rank better on industrial property than on commercial property because we don't tax machinery the way a lot of states do. So industry that's heavy in machinery, we're a little bit more competitive than we are with other types of business property when it comes to our property tax.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Willett.
Okay, real quickly, I want to touch on the Homestead Property Tax Burden Report, sometimes known as the Voss Report. This is a study that we do where we compare homestead property tax burdens as a percent of personal income. This uh, uh, this requires us to create a database where we're actually matching homestead property tax data to the income data of the homesteaders who live in those homesteads, which is a not insignificant task. But because of that, we are able to measure homestead property taxes in terms of the actual ability to pay, or at least the ability to pay of the homesteaders who live in the building, live in the homestead. This first map shows what the median burden is for the homesteaders by region in the state. Homestead tax burdens are higher in the metro area than they are in greater Minnesota. They're highest in Minneapolis and lowest in southwestern Minnesota. And I can come back to this slide, but for a minute I want to talk about some of the reasons why we have variation from one jurisdiction to another, one region to another. There's a lot of the things that go into determining property taxes that can affect this burden measure. Number one is the level of public services. The level and costs of local spending vary significantly. Regions that have a lot of township or unincorporated areas are going to have less government and less government that draws money on the property tax than more urbanized areas. School district referenda vary significantly from one part of the state to another, so that can really impact how much the homestead tax burdens are. And then just generally community preferences for local services vary from one part of the state to another. So that level of public service is an important determinant in homestead tax burdens. Secondly, intergovernmental aid and other revenue sources. Different jurisdictions rely more heavily on the property tax than others. Some have access to state and federal revenues that others do not. Some use fees and charges more than others. Some use special assessments more than others. So the mix of revenues that are used to pay for public services can impact the ultimate homestead tax burden. A third factor is tax-based composition. Those jurisdictions where homestead values are the major source of tax base, they're going to pay the lion's share of all the property taxes. In other parts of the state where agricultural land is the primary source of market value, then homesteads may be paying a little bit less because there's the farm property that's picking up a big share of the cost. In other parts of the state, the seasonal recreational property is the primary payer of property taxes, and that can reduce the share paid by homesteads. Some individual jurisdictions may have a power plant or a major industry that picks up most of the property taxes, thereby relieving the homesteads from burden. All these, there are credits and exclusions and refunds that can also differentially impact the burdens. So all those issues explain in some parts some of the variation in this chart. We have not had the time or the ability to try and tease out which of those factors explain what share of the variation. But I think it's important to keep those in mind anyway when you see this map and you think about the variation from one region to another in the homestead property tax burdens. This chart shows homestead property tax burdens by income range. So when we were talking about the regressivity of the property tax, I think it's illustrated pretty well by this table. This data, by the way, is for property taxes in 2008. That is the most recent income data we were able to get. So things have obviously changed a lot since 2008, as we were discussing a little bit earlier. So take this with a grain of salt. This was taxes before at the time the recession was just starting. So things may have changed since then. But as of 2008, what you'll see is going down the chart shows homesteads broken up by ranges of income. And you'll see that the percent of income paid in property taxes steadily decreases the further up the income scale you go. What you'll also see if you move, so that's the regressivity of the property tax. What you'll see when you look from left to right on the chart is the impact of the market value homestead credit and the property tax refund on moderating the regressivity of the system. If we had neither the PTR or the market value credit and everything else in the system was the same, the range from top to bottom of the income range would be 7.6% of income to 1.9% of income. The applying the market value homestead credit moves us to the middle column, where you see that the gap between the top and the bottom gets a little bit closer. But remember that the market value homestead credit is not income tested, so it's not quite as powerful in reducing the regressivity as the property tax refund, which is income tested, and the impact of the property tax refund takes you from the middle column to the right column, and after you apply the impact of the property tax refund, then for medians anyway, the difference from the top to the bottom is 3.8 to 1.8%, so you're getting a whole lot closer, still regressive as a percent of income, but a whole lot closer from top to bottom.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Willett, would it be accurate to say that regressivity could be a symptom of both tax policy and of the voluntary exchange between a lender and a buyer? That is to say that, you know, if a lender approves a loan for someone of a lower income and they're living in a property that has, you know, X value, that percentage-wise, when we're talking about regressivity, that would seem to be more regressive. So is there, are there two different factors, or is there a way that that's calculated out of this situation? Just want your comments on that.
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, there's a lot of factors, I think, that go into this. I think the regressivity is a measure of the result of all the choices that are and incentives that are in the system, including what amount of housing people choose to consume and where they're at in the life cycle of their housing. There was the phenomenon I mentioned earlier of the older people who've been in a home for a long time, and maybe they purchased what was affordable at the time 30 years ago but is no longer affordable, or people may have just overconsumed last year. I mean, there's going to be a mix of everything, or maybe people who just lost their job. So the mismatch between income and consumption level. Another important factor, and you'll see that the under 10,000 income are not listed here. One of the reasons for that is we're trying to tease out the burdens are even higher in that lowest income. What we're trying to tease out, and we think we'll be able to say something about when we have maybe one or two more years worth of income data, is how many people in that lowest bracket are continually in that lowest bracket versus temporarily poor. There's a good share of those in the other 10,000 that actually have negative income, which is an indication of business losses. So it may be that, you know, for that year, they have no taxable income, but over the course of living in the home, they really don't have an affordability problem. So that's another factor that we need to tease out of this, but we only have 2 years of data so far, and we want a little bit more before we dig into that complicated of an issue.
Senator Peterson, follow up?
Yeah, I mean, so it is possible that through a buying decision, you could end up with something that appears to be regressive, essentially.
Mr. Willett.
Yeah, Madam Chair, sorry if I over-answered there. Yes. that last chart was medians, and medians and averages are usually where we as statisticians tend to start, but medians can mask extremes at the ends, and I think it's important to note that that extreme burdens exist way beyond what the medians are by region. So this chart shows by region what percent of the homesteaders in 2008 had a property tax burden greater than 5% of their income. The blue bar is what the amount they paid was, and the red bar is after receiving the property tax refund, what the net result was. And what this shows is that statewide in every part of the state, there's a decent share of homesteaders that have a property tax burden greater than 5% of their income. There are more, and it's more predominant in the metropolitan area. But throughout the state, the property tax refund is really important in reducing the number or the share of homesteads that have a property tax burden over 5%. So, for example, if you look at Minneapolis, which is the highest bar, without the property tax refund, more than 35% of the homesteaders in Minneapolis would have a property tax burden over 5%. After the application of the refund, it's down to about 22% of the homesteaders in Minneapolis. And it varies from region to region in the state. There were other indicators in the legislation I mentioned. The tax incidence study, which I think Paul Wilson may have presented to here or at the
presented to the tax committee.
Okay, at the tax committee. That looks at all taxes and how regressive or progressive they are. The tax expenditure budget, which looks at all the various ways preferences are given through the tax code rather than through direct spending. our assessment sales ratio study, which I talked about at the beginning of my presentation, and local impact notes, which look not at the impact of legislation on the state government, but what is the impact of legislation on local governments. All those can help keep track of the property tax system in one way or another. So lots of information, lots of indicators, lots of things to look at. I'll leave you with one final chart. This is, again, from the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, from the data that goes into their report. And this is kind of complicated, but I think it's a important thing to realize. This shows the ratio, the relationship between the tax on a $300,000 residential property and a $300,000 commercial property. So it's how much bigger is the commercial property tax to the homestead property tax of the same value. So how much preference is residential property being given? And I put this together for a couple of reasons. One is to show that Minnesota is above the average, but not at the top in terms of the relationship between commercial and residential property, at least for this sample property in this year. But it also shows that virtually every state has some way to give some level of preference to residential property. There's only two states at the very end where you have a one-to-one relationship between the tax paid by a $300,000 home and a $300,000 business. So everywhere in the state, everywhere in the country, property taxes give preference to almost everywhere to residential property. Minnesota does it, is above average in terms of the level to which we give preference to residential property, but certainly not at the very extreme either. So we have all this complexity, we have all this shifting, but what we're doing is maybe a little bit different in level, but it's not different in kind from what other states do with their property tax system.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is chart is very interesting. To me, it shows a few states that are biased, the border states, South Dakota, Wisconsin, North Dakota, that are significantly better in relationship to commercial versus residential property. I know this isn't your area. Do you know when businesses leave our state, do you know where they go? Is there is that something you would look at when you look at this and determine where are commercial property tax rates compared to other states around us?
Mr. Willett?
Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, I do not know that answer. It may be that the Department of Employment and Economic Development tracks that more closely than we do.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. Very good.
Chair,
terrific information, Mr. Willett. Mm-hmm. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome. Thank you all for your kind attention.
Okay. All right. I think we're going to adjourn for the day, members. We would like to hear from Joel Michael, but we'll wait till next week. So thank you very much, and our committee is adjourned.